The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show first broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
The Christchurch Mosque Stories Part 1, 2, 3 and 4 reflect the views and opinions as researched by Ben Vigin alone, and Ben Vigin alone is responsible for their content. In saying all of that, it's amazingly well backed up with incredible amounts of documentation, and I strongly suggest anybody wanting to know more about this very, very important aspect of the money financing of terrorism in New Zealand would basically best to come to my website, which is called the Dyslexic Detective, postmanproductions.com. In fact, look for the Dyslexic Autistic Detective if you're having trouble searching for Google, as sometimes the sites that are a little bit controversial tend to be shadow pushed down the bottom. And if you really like what I'm doing, then get in contact with me, media@gmail.com, and I'll give you the details of how to make not a donation but to become one of our subscribers, in which we provide a kind of an organic research service as well. So I don't believe in just begging for the sake of begging. I want everybody to have access, but I want my subscribers to get something special for it. So everything that I've come saying on these last four shows is backed up there. They've also been in State Secrets, so please do go and actually read those books, which are also on my site, and they again include additional documentation and bibliography to the research in these last four shows, which, to re-emphasise, is my views and my content, and I alone am responsible for it. Good evening. This is a day after, in fact, there's been a big military exercise down to today in Christchurch. I think it's called something like that, the Gods of War. 4 days ago, back in 2019, would have made the March 15th, which is when the Christchurch shooting with the massacre at the Aunor Mosque and attempted massacre at Lynwood resulted in the deaths of collectively of 51 people and thousands of lives actually impacted. Generally, the media narrative tended to focus on the fact that it would say they are us, actually missing the major significant point is that they were not they were we. Everybody in New Zealand was impacted on that day as much as anybody who was in New Zealand at the time that the Rainbow Warrior blew up when it was attacked by members of the French Secret Service in 1987 in a massive demonstration of, bear in mind that the French were our allies, that actually state terrorism does exist and is alive and actually well. I'm not going to do the show today to attempt to actually try and tell you what the cause of Christchurch or the March 15th actually is, and I am incredibly deeply cynical of anybody that actually is. Numerously, what I'll also find is that most of the people that you should actually get a red flag for, they will be obsessive about what actually events actually happen at the mosque. That will be the entire focus of the narrative, is to get you to look at what happened at the mosque, and specifically what happened at the end of the video. That, in some ways, is the ultimate psychological warfare operation and the hand of the magician at here, because I believe that while everyone was charging and striving to actually examine what happened specifically at the mosque on March 15, the real answer, or at least the real education about how we should be looking at the events of March 15th, by what else did we see happening outside of the mosque, or before and after, and as a consequence to that event, and what does that actually tell us about New Zealand, and what lessons can we learn about this, or what should be we very wary of, because what other red flags did it actually illustrate? Now, I know Christchurch very, very well, and I know both of these mosques very, very well. In fact, the Aunor one, when I used to go to school in Canterbury at Hagley High, and then when I went to university, and Boys High as well, but when I went to university at Christchurch University, where I did my degree in political science and was studying basically counter-terrorism and political violence, again, I can go through, you know, literally I would have written hundreds of thousands of words on the topic academically. But I was also engaged in the New Zealand Army Reserves, or for 6 years through the Royal 3-Field Headquarters, and then became the 32E. Then basically I transferred over 2nd First, the Army Reserves Infantry, where I basically did infantry and did work with reconnaissance. Whereas before I had artillery, it was artillery intelligence, counterintelligence, field intelligence was part of the Force Intelligence Group, either with 3-Field Headquarters or on attachment. Wasn't James Bond, but I have a very good understanding of security process through the field, on the ground, and academically, and have written about this topic for more than 35 years of my life, including I have in cases my examples of, if you read my article on Pacific Jihad, I forecast the attack on Osama bin Laden on America using jumbos. It's in the third paragraph in the article that I co-wrote with the publisher Ian Wishart, who only where it is. Ian is very right of me. In fact, I'd say he's centre-right. I'm going to be fair to him. I was always centre-left. We grew up in differences and we meant that way. But that article, actually the end result, stands by itself by the results. I also, Ian, published my book, State Secrets, my first original book, And in that book, there's a page there where I focus very much on Gun City, the gun shop in Christchurch, where the shooter actually bought his material. And I talked about the dangers of National Front groups and their links to basically state. And one of the examples I talked about was Kyle Chapman, who went on to head a trust that was basically paid for by the police and the Prime Minister's Crime Prevention for homeless skinheads, which if you've ever lived in Christchurch, you know, it's like, yes, there are homeless people, but they're not, skinhead isn't really kind of a genre. But regardless of that, that trust, which I identified in my book, State Secrets, it went on until 2014 when it was finally shut down because there were indiscrepancies by the trust that was being run by Carl Chapman, who had reformed multiple times, that regardless of his constant brushes and basically facts that it obviously clearly he was extremely outright that we're talking about, he managed to keep this trust until 2014 when he funded the right-wing resistance group, which went on to recruit people from Australia, including members of the military, to fight in the Ukraine with the Azov militias. And there is actually some very interesting questions about specifically which units they're working for and where those units were in 2014. But we'll move on. So let's gain the gain, and that just gives you the warm up for the idea that supposedly the argument is that nobody in the security services was looking at right wing organizations, they're only looking at left wing organizations when this all happened, and they had no particular knowledge of that particular event. Well, aside from the fact that I've actually been in the living room of a former skinhead and seen the ID of a member of the Christchurch Police Intelligence, whose building at that time was actually on Bealey Avenue, pretty much about where all the transmission stopped and no one could get any cell phone blinks, that building is now abandoned, but there's a big transmitter radio, so that's where the police intelligence building at that time was. No longer is there, I don't know where it is, so I'm not just releasing state secrets. But that particular person's card was on this person, my colleague, an old colleague, someone who you kind of are friendly with, but you don't work with, but, you know, anyway, a guy I knew. And the card on that particular card said, you know, police intelligence. I asked him what it was for, and he said, oh, well, he was asking me about whether I knew anybody from Combat 88. So we can see 2014 that the Christchurch police are looking for UK connections. And again, why they're looking for them is probably also as a consequence of things like Anders Breivik, the Norwegian shooter that shot up a whole bunch of Labour MPs in Norway and did it sort of, you know, like basically, you know, had all these fantasies where he wearing crazy steel uniforms and wearing Masonic aprons. And turned out that when they investigated the apron connection, that it was like tied up to this far right fascist called the British Resistance. Anyway, it was a kind of a big mainstream national, like the National Front group. And this recently a group of their guys also turned up when it turned out that there was sort of a rather anti-Maori statement said at the Nelson Club, and turned out that the guy who made it was also connected to this group, and Nick Smith, who tried to bring in a Muslim to speak to the club, but actually didn't kick this guy out and he was allowed to stay on, you know. And that's just showing you the kind of saying, oh, we weren't investigating. Well, we actually were, but you weren't doing anything about it. That's actually really the reality of what was going on. So of course, this big argument, like, oh, well, no, we didn't, we weren't examining them, which agreed my book, and you understand why I can show you there are cases where they were looking at the right wing, they just weren't doing anything about it. And a lot of time, those right wing connections had some very dubious connections to basically mercenary groups, and I just mentioned to you, Ethan Telling. So the number one argument we have is saying that, well, actually, well, we weren't managing, the statement that came out very long was, well, we didn't know because we weren't managing these 4chan and 8chan social media platforms that the shooter had been attending. Again, shooter also had this sort of, like Andrew Vervick's, had this connection to these Knight Templars and pseudo-Masonic groups in Masonry, and his entire manuscript is actually made up of these things. So again, we don't want to, apparently we're not allowed to look at this, we're not allowed to talk about this issue, but it's out there, so go and look it up yourself if you don't believe that I'm saying it's true. I'll assure you, in fact, a source I can drive you to is his own manuscript, which I could explain to you a number of linguistics issues about what I have a problem with. A person that hasn't finished school wrote that, but what we do know is that whoever wrote that made the same linguistic arguments that appeared on the 4chan and 8chan channels that resulted in the New Zealand police shutting down the Otago University in 2015 because they were alarmed by some of the statements that was made by a person that had the same linguistic characteristics as we now know that Brenton Tarrant has, due to the linguistic study done by the Auckland University. So that would seem to completely contradict the police's idea that they didn't know that and they weren't monitoring 4chan and 8chan. And of course, possibly we could, you know, take that up with Jacinda Ardern, the daughter of a policeman who actually wrote the review on police corruption in the United Kingdom, or was part of it, under the Freemasons, Sir Ronnie Flanagan's, and who in the end said, well, let's use the IPCA model, which as we all know is a joke anyway, and then then she got a Freemason scholarship to go and study spin doctoring and public relations in an American university. We could talk about that, but that would be unkind. So let's instead talk about the fact that it was this idea that the shooting was all the result of what was going online. Well, you know, again, there was a committee that was held years beforehand about whether or not we should be selling weapons online. And all the experts said, no, that's a really, really dumb idea. And Jacinda Ardern, who was the senior person in this committee, went ahead and did it. And I suppose if she was to turn around and that was to be pointed out about the police not monitoring 4 and 8chan when they weren't, then I guess they could come back and say, well, Ardern, you actually were the member of the committee, so they actually haven't. So each side has actually done a very good job of protecting each other's ass. But again, I'll point you out for the source of that is 2015. We also have Selwyn Skanks of Centrefire, Dunedin gun shop in Dunedin, basically warning about how online sales were absolutely rapid. I think there was a woman, there was a head of the police maybe, she also did an article about this and she got into trouble for actually buying a weapon. And gosh, no, I think it might have been Gun City even that she bought it off, and it sort of it all turned around about how dare she buy it, you know, sneakily, when nobody actually turned around and said, well, how is it that she could buy a gun off Gun City online and how is this even possible? And that story was actually sidelined and, you know, ignored, along with the one I said about Selwyn Skanks. And I was also writing stories from there in 2015, going all the way back to 2007 about these issues of firearms, which again have been availability in New Zealand, which again have been a big part of my best-selling book State Secrets, which sold over 15,000 copies and was on bestsellers for 3 months. So don't say no one didn't know about what I had to say about basically, you know, the right wing in Christchurch and Gun City. Now, this just to examine the situation here, it's like, as far as I'm aware, David Gray has never done any, he's never, well, actually, it's not an issue of he's somehow responsible for the Christchurch shooter, but it's a question of how was he, did he manage to operate so long? And I do have questions about that, and I'm not the only one, because at the end of the day, he's repeatedly sold weapons to gangs, he sold them to the headhunters in one single case. Well, in fact, he sold them to a person who then turned around and sold them to the headhunters, to be absolutely correct. And in previous cases against them, about gangs had fallen over because of technicality issues, but there were issues about basically who he was actually selling weapons to. And again, this actually landed him in jail in the United States, where he came back. He didn't have a problem traveling to Australia, which is, you know, busily, you know, sending anyone guilty of a criminal offence back to New Zealand. The irony of that is that Mary Tully, who did a report on Gun City's involvement, basically, and then, you know, their fairly shonky record, she was actually allowed into the country about 2 years ago, because she had actually written a detrimental report about a dictator and more a politician with dictatorial characteristics in Malaysia. And we basically had this policy where anyone who had been in that situation denied a visa, they couldn't just walk into the country, even though they were normally eligible to do so. Eventually that's got been sorted out, but it's kind of interesting that she gets pinged even though she's actually done nothing wrong, and David Tipple of Gun City, who goes to an event to, you know, for his witness's daughter's shooting, and despite the fact he has this previous record for travelling, you know, for spending time in jail for basically buying off handguns off dubious elements from fairs, you know, and not declaring them properly, he calls it a technicality, but the reality is you spent a year in jail, end of story. Again, this guy was out there, and this is also the guy that he's mentioned providing equipment to the people that were involved in Operations 8. He's also recognised as providing the weapons to David Gray. You know, the guy has a record. It's just incredible. You know, again, the issue isn't about all the other people. It's about here's one bad apple, and how somehow, after repeated breaches of just this operator, he now has more guns than I think gun stores than any other. It's incredible. Nothing slows this guy down. So yeah, let's go back to look at some of these other events that were happening in Dunedin and with firearms that basically show you that actually there was a massive flare went up over Dunedin, almost over the house of where the bad guy was living, and the famous Dunedin Keystone cops, the cops that appear in an inquiry, you know, that we all know the David Bain case, we all know the Ben and Hope and Olivia Smart case, we know how basically members of both investigations were involved in that, we know the stories chapter again, and yet these same guys, nothing actually happens to the core groups in this element. They just get promoted every year, and when they actually had a royal inquiry into this particular culture in Dunedin, what resulted was these detectives actually went out and hired a private detective to try and dig up dirt on that particular justice. And of course, what also happened, and again, I'll make this amount of point of issue, is that when it turned out that there were issues happening with the gun club that should have been spotted by this group of police, what did they do? Oh, they went out and sent themselves to investigate themselves, which they had actually said is how the Independent Police Complaints Authority, which Jacinda Ardern sent to the UK when they had an issue of corruption within the Freemasons, Operation Barbarus, mainstream news story, by the way, they went ahead and did it anyway. Okay, so the Keystone Cops, and the Keystone Cops, we go back to them. Okay, so 2003 on to 2015, I'm writing stories about basically the dodgy arms and black market in Dunedin and throughout the country. I'm talking about how there's mercenary groups that are turning up to the gun club in Dunedin, how they're like turning up with, you know, very cool looking toys, and the cops instead of saying, well, hey, what's going on here, they turn around and join in the shooting up there. So we talked about the specific culture that occurred, and again, this particular, there was a military veteran who also identified this in the, and was actually got as far as being mentioned in the Royal Inquiry, but the police turned around and said, oh no, he's alive. A number of handguns and firearms and over 25,000 rounds. That's enough to provide a small army of our arms goes, disappears from Maitland Street, the Pistol Dunedin Pistol Club, the people that vetted for the, he's a good sort of kind of guy, Brenton Tarrant, who was sisters of the Dunedin Club, which is where the guy, Brenton Tarrant, shooted, also practiced for the shooting, which our military veteran said had this culture of basically doing things like dragging targets that look like human beings and using them to shoot at Confederate flags, but, you know, military bayonets attached to weapons, you know, and saying, hey, I thought I saw something very hinky going on. This is, again, the culture club that I said, well, actually, we know that the cops also shoot about that, and they had a real boys kind of, you know, culture, and I'd spoken about this specifically. So this particular pistol club, which has this, you know, cozy little relationship going on, gets broken into, you know, open safe, and they basically walk out of the open safe, the and when I say open I mean unlocked, and they wander off. There's no prosecution for the guy who involved, who had all these weapons from the pistol club stored there. There's no, hey, wait a minute, you're not, you actually broached the rules. So that just gets missed out, the fact, oh, isn't terrible, you got broken into. And there's a handful of these guns make it back, and the cops give them big slap on the back as these guns disappear into the hills, Hells Angels, Headhunters, and via the Bandidos, who used to be the Southern Vikings, which is part of the white biker culture, which included at that time used to be the Road Knights, and I think also things like Satan Slaves, which is now basically that's sort of gone. It's all about the money, but the old boys are still there in the backdrop, you know, calling a lot of shots, and we've sort of seen a lot of the resurgence of that kind of culture coming back when following the arrival of the 501s, who are a culture of criminals, which our dearest little allies across the ditch are dropping into us in the thousands of people. And these are a culture of people that have extreme violence, who use guns, and they're arriving just in time for a really, really dumb gun law response that's going to now result in thousands of weapons actually going into the black market and creating a black market that basically, I wouldn't say didn't exist because I wrote an entire book about it, but a culture we were told that didn't exist, but now certainly does, as a consequence of the reactionaryism to the events of March 15th by somebody who was responsible for ignoring warnings for this to actually take place, and who will later claim excessive credit for an event that her security forces failed to actually prevent. Am I being too harsh, you ask? I don't think so, and I'm going to keep on continuing to tell you why. You're on the Deadline Report with Fresh FM, and this is Ben Vidge Investigates, and we may very much turn this into a two-parter, because there's a lot to cover in this particular area. So we know, okay, so this, you know, the 2017, before the Christchurch shooting, but where we now know that the shooter is now living in Dunedin. He has arrived, he has had his membership vetted by the Dunedin Pistol Club, who has lost thousands of rounds from a club that has an extremely dubious history. He's connected to an organisation called the Right Wing Resistance that is established by a recipient of a police grant for crime prevention, which, even though the guy keeps on breaking the law and carrying out crime, he still gets being put in charge of it all the way to 2014, when he's recruiting mercenaries to go and fight in the war in the Ukraine. And as I said to you, we know that this particular gun club was also attached to the mercenary industry. I've again written about this in Deadline. And if the police were the police and they wanted to look at the ODT and they wanted to go and look around the buildings there, I think you'd find the company in question, which I'm talking about. Everybody knows who I'm talking about. They carried out the famous fight clubs that used to go on in Dunedin, and which were basically excessive, and which the police never got involved in with as well. And because, again, I guess the particular outfit that we're talking about, interestingly enough, also trained the Dunedin police in hand-to-hand combat. And funny enough, a lot of those guys were really into funny aprons and handshakes as well. Go figure. That brand is coming up a hell of a lot. And in fact, when we turn around, we look at the money laundering side of that was happening in Christchurch, and we look at where that leads up, I guess we're going to end up finding ourselves, when we follow the money, coming back to the same group of funny handshakes and the same luxury lodge, which, gosh darn it, they happen to have spy meetings here. And some of those spy meetings, like the ones that held at Melbrook, when all the Five Eyes guys got together, That was like the first, they had one there in 2001 after 9/11, and that was, you know, right after they talked about the project for a new American century, and they're going to have all these justifications for American military expansion going all over the world, including heading eastwards, despite the not one inch north east, according to the James Baker document signed in 1991 as part of the Perestroika agreements. But yeah, let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's go. Let's get back to the unlock safes. They had turned one. They also, what was happening was that the people that carried out that particular raid, where only a few handguns actually occurred, also took a logbook of everybody that actually had firearms and where they lived. And guess what? Those places started getting robbed. I wonder what they would say in the Dunedin report cases about that and the Pacific firearms. And I wonder if people in the Dunedin police, for example, in the detective rooms, suddenly noticed that there were a lot more burglaries involving firearms going on beforehand. And I wonder if they sent that up the road too far up to Wellington. And Wellington turned around and suddenly looked at the statistics and went, holy mother of blah, 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 what the hell is going on here? Maybe we need to pay a little bit more closer attention to the gun culture in New Zealand. The gun culture where, again, people like Selwyn from Skanks from Centrefire had turned around and said, hey, there are all these people turning around and buying pubs, guns out of the pubs from guns that they bought online. And we're getting pretty wary about what's going on here. So, you know, despite all these burglaries, nobody bothered to look closely at these clubs, and nobody bothered to turn around when the guy from the gun shop, the ammunition provider, had provided these arms and said, basically sent off an email and said, well, to the police, actually, I think you probably need to have a go and look at this guy or vet this guy, because actually that's what you should be doing anyway, but nobody did, and that never actually came up in the Royal Inquiry, along with whether it was explained to you why the fact that who actually said it was okay to sell weapons online to begin with, even though the experts, and like someone had told us not to. Red flag after red flag after red flag after red flag after red flag got missed. And again, we know that there were cases of people at the mosque who were warned of Pacific threats just in the months beforehand. We know of cases of people at a rave, Golden Bay, encountering Brenton Tarrant, who was in travelling with a psychiatrist from Dunedin known as Neve, who had said, you know, a bit worried about your friend. And then this woman, Neve, said, look, don't worry, we'll report it to the police. And I've spoken to these people directly. We never did hear about what actually happened to that case, but that's one case that I was aware of, where it was made aware that people did think that Brenton Tarrant was odd. And I'm aware of other cases, and I'm aware of members of the judiciary who are aware of other cases who are also actually investigating that. And no, you will not find that on my hard drive or my emails, because actually none of that information I ever bothered to keep anywhere on me or actually bother to make over telephone. And I've already explained to the case about the veteran who said, hey, this culture sucks. And we've told you about the fight clubs and their links to the mercs and their links to the motorcycle gangs that had white supremacist overtones. And we know about the fact that the ammunition of the, when the guy was telling the guy that was telling about how he, you know, had said he was war concerned about this guy and he was making a submission. In the middle of a submission, video submission, it just accidentally got cut. And the media didn't want to cover that story either. And so we know about David Gray. And we know about this particular case. Well, next week we're going to look into the money laundering side of things, which gets really, really interesting about what was going on in Christchurch. And we'll introduce that separately. But what we do know is that there was a lot of warnings that something wasn't right. And the police missed every single one of them. And it was quite precise, in fact, in terms of the groups that were involved and how they'd come across and they tripped over warning signals beforehand. We know that online they've been detected. And again, just going back to the point, I guess it's sort of, you know, digging for things I want to fill out the last couple of minutes, is that so when they had the Melbourne meeting after the Five Eyes, you know, 9/11, they then had another meeting called Take It Back the Internet. And that was basically about strategies which they were going to use to allow the authorities to actually censor media on content. And this idea was that they were to deplatform people who they didn't like. Well, then there's people like Samantha Power's husband who worked for Homeland Security describing it as nudging. And we find out that effectively a lot of the people that are involved in the Christchurch call and the funders of it, people like Qatar, Saudi Arabia, have a fairly, fairly dubious history of terrorism themselves. But I'm going to leave you on that today, because I think I'm going to hold a lot of the stuff back to next week when I turn around and talk about the money laundering connections to the Christchurch mosque incident, and hopefully fill your brains with some rather more kind of how in the hell did they miss that. And again, not here to tell you what actually happened. I'm just here to tell you, like, hey, there was something odd about the event that took place on March 15th in 2019, and not enough questions have been asked. You know, even right down to the fact that we know that there were three, not one, but three military exercises took place in Christchurch on the day of the event. And One of them was Operation Nocturnal Owl, which was its job was to basically a covert delivery, a clandestine delivery of kind of material that you might need if there'd been a mass terrorism, and you need much medical attention, you need material to plug in for media outlets, and all of that just happened to be in Christchurch because of this exercise was taking place at the same time that there was also a special forces snipers exercising. And I know that there were people involved at the at that particular exercise who were completely surprised about this event as anybody else, but it doesn't mean that there weren't people there that weren't. And we can look at some of the forensics and basically suggest that there was a very strong sign that the shooter at Christchurch also had at the very minimal had spotter support. We'll get into some of the stuff next week, but those are the things that we took around and said. The third operation was the one that took place at St. Margaret's Hospital, involving two police officers who belonged to the same funny handshake club as Brent and Trent, as a matter of fact, but they just happened to be the ones that managed to just detain him. And while he had been shooting and firing anyone else, he managed to get himself captured without being shot by those guys. And I'll leave as a second point. I am saying that the person that's in jail now isn't Brent and Trent. There is no evidence at this current age to suggest that anything actually is anything other than the case. But there is also an equal truism to the situation, is that we have never had one singular source actually solidly confirm, that's my brother. That's the guy I used to work with. No cases, face-to-face encounters where we confirm that actually is Brenton Tarrant. For all we know, even as Brenton Tarrant's mother wasn't ever allowed access to the media or allowed to turn around and say, oh, my son, I don't know why my son did that. For all we know, Brenton Tarrant could actually be lying face down in a ditch, and that guy, whoever he is, has been let out for on the weekends. Not saying that's the case, don't get me wrong, but what I'm saying is the level of questions that weren't asked, the basic levels of questions in this particular event. I'm sorry, this smells kind of kinky and stinky. Christchurch shooting, March 15th, 2019, is one of those events. This is Ben Virgin Investigates on the Deadline Report, Kira Fresh FM. The Christchurch Mosque Stories, Part 1, 2, 3 and 4, reflect the views and opinions as researched by Ben Virgin alone, and Ben Virgin alone is responsible for their content. In saying all of that, it's amazingly well backed up with incredible amounts of documentation, and I strongly suggest anybody wanting to know more about this very, very important aspect of the money financing of terrorism in New Zealand would basically best to come to my website, which is called the Dyslexic Detective, postmanproductions.com. In fact, look for the Dyslexic Autistic Detective if you're having trouble searching for Google, as sometimes the sites that are a little bit controversial tend to be shadow pushed down the bottom. And if you really like what I'm doing, then get in contact with me, media down under gmail.com, and I'll give you the details of how to make not a donation but to become one of our subscribers, in which we provide a kind of an organic research service as well. So I don't believe in just begging for the sake of begging. I want everybody to have access, but I want my subscribers to get something special for it. So everything that I've been saying on these last four shows is backed up there. They've also been in State Secrets, so please do go and actually read those books, which are also on my site, and they again include additional documentation and bibliography to the research in these last four shows.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.